I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program State Senator Peter Wirth. He is speaking tonight at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Community Foundation with the Amigos Bravos Water Matters Lecture Series. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
So water does matter, and one of the things that we've talked about on this program before when we talked to Linda Siegel and various other people during the legislative session is that the legislative session happens in the winter when we're not in the middle of drought season and wildfire season and water restrictions and all of that, and water legislation doesn't necessarily get the focus that it needs.
You know, I think that's very true, and this particular session was fascinating because obviously we start the session with a State of the State address by the governor, and it was interesting to me and to many members of the Senate caucus that I serve in that there was no mention whatsoever of water by Governor Martinez, and that certainly was different than what we've all been hearing on the ground in the districts we represent. Interestingly, it's true, the legislature meets in the winter months, and I think the fact that water did kind of come out as a huge issue in this session is indicative of the fact that even though we're in the winter months, this drought is here, it's real, and people are scared. And so I was, it kind of all came together for me. Senator Michael Sanchez, our majority floor leader, in his response to the governor, called water the sleeper issue of the session. And subsequently, I was pointed to chair the Senate Conservation Committee, which deals with all the water issues and land use issues and things of that nature, land grants and energy issues. And so all of a sudden, water was elevated for the first time in the 9 years that I've served. It was elevated to the point that the leadership of the Senate, the President Pro Tem, Mary Kay Papin, and Senator John Arthur Smith, the Chairman of Finance, all participated in multiple hearings, in press conferences, and I think I knew things were different when Senator Smith, who obviously chairs the Finance Committee and has been through an unbelievable 4 or 5 years trying to balance budgets in incredibly difficult times, when he said that water was the single most important issue in this session, I knew things were different.
And so what happened? I mean, a couple of bills got passed, your bills.
Well, actually, yeah, I did have two bills that passed, and again, bills that had been in the mix and in the discussion for many, many years. Both deal with domestic wells, one of those kind of third rail toxic issues in the legislature, and subdivisions, another issue that causes huge challenges for us to move legislation. And these two bills, Senate Bill 479 and 480, basically stop what I think is flat-out double-dipping, where you're putting a subdivision in without water rights and using domestic wells. And I will tell you, when I introduced those bills, I wasn't sure I could get them through the committee that I chair, let alone through the Senate and then the House, and then the governor signed both the bills. And I think it's a real signal of the seriousness of this issue, and something that Randy Traynor, who's a lobbyist for the home builders, who actually started off neutral on these bills and ended up supporting them. He said something during the session in committee that really struck home and I think kind of defines the direction moving forward. He said, things have changed. And when the New Mexico home builders, who certainly benefit from subdivisions, are willing to stand up and say, things have changed, the status quo can't continue this way, you know, we can begin to make progress at the legislative level. But, you know, to be honest, these are two relatively small bills given the magnitude of the challenge.
So things have changed. There's several things that have changed. What are they?
Well, let me say this. The biggest thing that's changed is the amount of water in the river. And the Rio Grande is basically says stop flowing in many parts of this state. I've been amazed to just be down in Belen, Las Lunas, and coming up north and driving across the bridge, and there's no water in the river. Go to Las Cruces, there's no water in the river. And this has got huge consequences for New Mexico's economy. And of immediate issue is the agricultural economy below Elephant Butte Dam. And so we have got the kind of perfect storm of 3 years of drought, I think climate change impacting big time, litigation with Texas in the U.S. Supreme Court, and we've got a situation where there simply is not enough surface water, so farmers are pumping water in a way that's completely unsustainable, and they know it, and they've admitted it. And so, you know, all of this kind of came together, and it's just, it's a fascinating, scary time, but also I think it's something that we have to deal with. And really what I'm going to talk about tonight is kind of learning to thrive with less. Because again, it's very easy to get so pessimistic and negative, but the reality is we've got less water. And we've got to figure out how to live with less water and conserve on all levels and really kind of move forward in a way that our state can survive.
What's the nature of the Supreme Court case about the litigation with Texas?
Well, this isn't the first time New Mexico has been in litigation with Texas over water. In the 80s, Texas sued over water on the Pecos River. And basically, New Mexico ended up settling that case, $14 million, and a requirement that we put water into the river to make sure it gets delivered to Texas. And interestingly, the New Mexico legislature, as a result of that case, made the decision to spend taxpayer dollars, close to $100 million in taxpayer money, to buy water rights. And over on the Pecos, it's unbelievable. We buy water rights from a farm, we drill a well, and we pump the water from the well into the river so that it can make it to Texas.
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, that kind of has been, that was a model that existed there. What's happened now is, again, it's kind of the perfect storm, and that's probably not the greatest analogy when there's no storm. We need the perfect storm.
Yeah, but, right.
What's happened is, on the lower Rio Grande, the Attorney General filed the initial challenge, initial lawsuit against the Bureau of Reclamation, because what's happened is the Elephant Butte Irrigation District has been pumping water in a way that I think everyone would acknowledge is not sustainable. And so this very delicate balance between groundwater and surface water is critical for our compacts. We have a compact on the Rio Grande River, and we are required to deliver a certain amount of water to Texas that goes over the spillway in Elephant Butte Dam. So here's what's fascinating. The water's in Elephant Butte, and it goes over the top of the dam, and yet because there's been so much pumping below the dam, the water goes in and the aquifer is connected to the river, and it just sinks right into the aquifer.
Oh my goodness.
So Texas isn't getting their share of water, and I think very unfortunately they saw the lawsuit that was filed in by New Mexico, and I think we've ended up in a situation where we're litigating against Texas, which is not a good place to be financially for the taxpayers.
Yeah, because litigation is very expensive.
Extraordinarily.
You're an attorney, you know.
That's right. That's right. And again, it just, over the years that I've been in the legislature, there have been real efforts to communicate with Texas and have our water folks talking to their water folks to prevent exactly this from happening. And so, to some extent, I think it's interesting because it kind of highlights what has to happen here, because we haven't, here's the other interesting piece to this, we haven't fully adjudicated the water rights in New Mexico. So our challenge is we haven't determined how much water each owner has and what the priority date has. And that makes it that much harder when there's not enough water. And senior water rights under our legal system, water law system, have priority. And what's supposed to happen under a strict application of priority law is that when there's not enough water, the senior water rights do what's called a call, which means the junior water rights have to shut off their use so the water gets to the seniors. So we haven't fully adjudicated, so we don't completely know who has what, number one. Number two, the junior water rights happen to be all the municipalities. And so realistically, we can't shut off the water to Albuquerque, Santa Fe. That's not going to happen. And so it puts us in a predicament where there's a whole legal structure that simply isn't going to solve the problem that we have immediately. And so one of the things I'm going to talk about tonight is kind of how we move forward in the kind of short term and long term.
We're talking to State Senator Peter Wirth. The way you describe it, you've got water rights that aren't fully adjudicated. You've got senior users and junior users. Junior users are the cities. Senior users are who?
Senior users tend to be agricultural Native Americans, certainly are the most senior. And, you know, we've got Native American Indian water rights settlements. Obviously, Amit is one that folks here in this area certainly hear a lot about. And I now represent some of the communities in the northern part of the Senate district that are directly impacted by those settlements. And so you've got this state, federal overlay, Native American rights. But interestingly, the senior users in agriculture, especially on the Rio Grande and the Pecos, a huge percentage of them are at the bottom of the river. So on the Pecos right now, the Carlsbad Irrigation District is the senior user, and they are not getting their water.
Yeah.
And so for the first time, they have actually issued a call of the river and put the state engineer in a position where the state engineer is going to have to figure out how to address this. How do you get water to Carlsbad?
Yeah. So, Santa Fe and Albuquerque, we're just not going to provide water for a few days. Just live with it. Fill your bathtubs. You know, that's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. And get this. Here's the other kind of twist to this whole thing. They're now, because of how much groundwater pumping has occurred and because of the drought, the magnitude of it, because the river is simply not flowing completely from north to south, there's now a whole doctrine called the futile call, because you could release all the water and it's just going to go straight into the aquifer. It's never going to make it to the senior user.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, we have hydrology, we've got legal issues, and I just think you put this all into kind of the legislature and what are we going to do about this, and it's kind of all coming at a point where we're going to have to sit down around the table and have the impacted users really come up with their own solution. Which one of the things I'll talk about tonight is that, of course, is the true New Mexico model. That's what acequias have done for years.
Instead of having a top-down solution where a bunch of cigar-smoking legislators decide how it's going to be, you have the so-called, I don't like this word, but the so-called stakeholders, basically the people who are involved, coming up with a solution themselves. And the thing is, we're all in it together. It's not like a gold mine or something that's in one place. It's water that's everywhere and increasingly nowhere. We all need it. We all drink it. We all use it. If you were to make a kind of like little bar graph of how much water is used by agriculture, how much is used by oil and gas, how much is used by other kinds of mining, by municipalities, by Indian pueblos, what does it look like?
And that's a great, great point. And I think it's something that is really still for me, when I hear these percentages, I kind of am amazed by it. Only 10% of the water in New Mexico is used by our municipalities.
Right.
75% is used in irrigated agriculture. And then the remaining 15%, some of it's evaporation, some of it is utility production, energy production. Obviously, this new oil and gas drilling technique of fracking uses a lot of water.
But it's still in that 15%.
It's still in that 15%. And so I think one of the things that as we move forward, the agricultural community itself is going to have to figure out how to deal with less, how to thrive with less. There are definitely discussions going on, not just in New Mexico, but in other states, about what is a crop that uses a little bit less water, different ways to till the field so that you keep the water moisture there. and or not till the field. I mean, these are things that can happen in agriculture. Conservation in agriculture is important. I think conservation, obviously, in the municipalities is critical. And Santa Fe, boy, what a terrific example for the rest of the state about what can happen when people actually make a conscientious effort, and you have leadership at the city and county level that are doing that.
It's kind of baloney because, I mean, we're sitting here turning off our water when we brush our teeth, and a couple of things happen. One is we're in the 10, all municipalities use only 10% of the water. So maybe we could bring that down to 9% or something like that. When we do that, that allows water rights to be given for development so that they can have put in more houses so that they can brush their teeth. So we're not saving anything.
Well, so here's the analogy. I mean, take the 10% and the 75%, and that assumes you're working with 100% water. Realistically, now we're probably working with 50 or 60% water.
Right.
And I do think
50 or 60% of what we say we have.
That's exactly right. So 50% of 10% is 5%. Except, let me just say that both Santa Fe and Albuquerque have taken advantage of the San Juan Chama water and the Buckman diversion here in Santa Fe, and there's also a diversion in Albuquerque. This is water that we're allocated that comes through a 16-foot pipeline from the Colorado River and gets piped over to the Rio Grande. And really the only reason we've got water in the river in Albuquerque is because of this Colorado water that's there. Also, Santa Fe has actively been out buying up water rights. And again, this is part of the question of, you know, transferring water rights between agriculture and municipal uses. And so one of the things that I think necessarily happens when you adjudicate is you have agricultural uses now where they're being done simply to maintain the right. In other words, you've got fields that are being flooded. I mean, I've been driving around the state just in the last couple of weeks up north, and it's unbelievable to see the amount of, you know, you got rivers that are just being emptied onto the fields. And so
right.
once those are adjudicated, then there may be an opportunity to move those water rights. But you're absolutely right about the growth question. I mean, I think that's the other question, is what's sustainable? And so we need to have that discussion. And I think the interesting piece about this legislative session is that here you had the New Mexico home builders willing to acknowledge that things have changed. And so, you know, this rampant growth using domestic wells, which just are, they just punch a hole in the aquifer without even bringing the water rights in, at least we've made some steps towards reducing that.
We're talking to State Senator Peter Wirth. I mean, the question of growth is really an interesting one, because even your most hardcore capitalist will acknowledge that in a state where there's drought, you cannot have infinite growth of cities. It doesn't work. We don't yet have pipelines to bring in desalinated water from the Gulf of Mexico, or which is, you know, I mean, some people's dream, but not very likely. I mean, water is one of those things that is, at this point in history, fundamentally local or regional. And so you can't have infinite economic growth. At the same time, when we talk about climate change and combating climate change and doing conservation and doing clean energy and doing energy storage and all of those things, part of the reason we're doing it is precisely for the economy, because if you have that much drought caused by climate change, then a lot of your industries suffer, like fishing, tourism, skiing.
How about rafting?
Yeah.
So check this out. This is wild. And Amigos Bravos, of course, is based out of Taos. And for 25 years, they've been champions for our rivers. And so I saw a very interesting little letter to the editor in the High Country News. And it was from someone who was in the rafting business, who was furious because what's happening in southern Colorado is the farmer, there's not enough water there. They're adjudicated. And the farmers are actually making decisions among themselves about which lands to fallow, kind of a model perhaps for New Mexico. But what's being grown in southern Colorado is hay for the dairies in New Mexico. And so all this water that otherwise would be going into the Rio Grande to provide the recreation through the Taos Box on rafts basically is growing hay which is going down to dairies, and we can have a huge discussion about dairies and, you know, whether that's a the type of industry that is in New Mexico. And I just thought it was fascinating because you are dead on. I mean, this is, rivers are important pieces of our communities for so many reasons. And I just think the idea of living with rivers that are dry, it just has a huge economic impact in itself.
So there are different kinds of agriculture. I mean, there's agriculture where we're growing animals and all kinds of different plant crops, and some of them use a lot more water than others. I once did a calculation just based on kind of rough numbers from the internet about whether New Mexico could be food self-sufficient with the water that we have, or we say we have, not import or export any food, whether we could do it. And by my calculations, which I'm sure are not exactly accurate, we could do it, but only if we had no beef at all. Beef apparently takes a lot of water.
Well, beef, and if anyone's ever driven through Doniana County and seen pecan trees that literally sit in 10 inches of water, that's how they are irrigated. And we've got a huge thriving pecan industry that's exported to China. And so you've got pecan farms that have tens of millions of dollars invested in growing pecans. And the thing with a pecan tree is they can't survive on half the water.
Yeah.
So
it's all or nothing.
It's all or nothing. And I think they've been surviving by pumping the aquifer dramatically. And they acknowledge, the Elephant Butte Irrigation District acknowledges that it's not sustainable. And so you are absolutely right. That's a perfect example of, okay, how do we deal with this? And again, I think this is why also at a certain point this crisis is going to connect at all political levels. And, you know, the governor didn't mention water in the state of the state, but I can assure you when you've got pecan farmers that are basically at a point where they are going to have to fallow and eliminate the crop that's making them millions of dollars, obviously the impact on our economy is huge. And so how we figure that out and the direction that we move forward is the challenge of the day.
Yeah, the next industry being pecan wood furniture.
Sure, maybe that's right. Maybe that's exactly right.
For one season. We're talking to Peter Wirth. So, I mean, when you look at what agricultural industries would be good for New Mexico, given the water that we have, are there any that do look good?
Well, I think that first of all, let me say this. This can't be an urban versus rural, city versus ag kind of deal. I mean, our agricultural communities are an incredibly vital part of our state. And I think figuring out what works and how that works. I mean, look at our northern New Mexico agricultural economy, which is much more small scale, acequias. The acequias have done a phenomenal job of being proactive at the legislative level and have kind of protected themselves. And again, I think you see a small scale. I think the question becomes kind of large scale agriculture and what kind of future we can look at there. I've been stunned to see the situation, I think, in Fort Sumner with cattle that are just dying because there's no water.
Oh, God.
And so, you know, all of these types of issues are going to have to be evaluated. And I think, you know, my hope would be ultimately that you've got the different water rights users sitting around the table figuring it out themselves.
Yeah.
Because you earlier you said, you know, having the cigar filled room in the legislature dictated, or quite frankly having someone wearing a black robe, the judge, telling somebody you don't get to do this, that's a very, very tough thing. And we're at a point where we don't have time.
Well, and what will happen is that the pumps will run dry. That's what will happen if we just continue doing exactly what we're doing now.
That's right. Or in the lower Rio Grande, the problem is salination. There's a salt content. And when all the water gets pumped out, the salt content continues to go up to a point that it's no longer viable for the crops. And so again, I think this is the immediate challenge. We had discussions during the legislature. There were bills to spend huge amounts of money to find water. And this is the pipeline issue you bring up. And there is always this kind of sense, well, we can just go find it somewhere and pipe it in. We're going to have a huge debate over the Gila River because there's specifically about $64 million that's available as part of this Arizona settlement on the Gila that's contingent on us building a diversion for 14,000 acre-feet of water. Now, you take 14,000 acre-feet of water, which sounds like a lot, but in reality, it's not that much. But taking it out of that incredible ecosystem and that stream and all of the economy that's based around that river and building pipelines and pumping it, I mean, I don't think that's a good idea. Yet that's a discussion we're going to actively have. And so we're facing, let me just say one more thing, Mary Charlotte, that's important too, is our neighbor to the east, Texas, they are in a full-out aggressive mode when it comes to water. They're spending money on water infrastructure. They are litigating everywhere they can because they know that economic development has to have water. And so, again, this is the kind of investment that New Mexico, I think, is going to have to do as well to make sure that we can sustain with what we have here and also make these tough choices.
We're talking to State Senator Peter Wirth. There's also some really big kind of philosophical and cultural issues going on here, and we talk on this program pretty often about monoculture, large-scale agriculture, which by all accounts that I can figure is an unsustainable use of the land, both in terms of what it does to the soil, in terms of the fact that it's very much petroleum-based, and the way it uses water, and the problems that wildlife have when they get sprayed with pesticides and how the bees are getting killed and they can't pollinate. And I mean, it's in many, many ways, monoculture agriculture is going to have to change. And that's part of the discussion of water, too. I mean, I don't think that everybody would sign up for going back to the very small self-sustained acequia systems of our ancestors. It's very hard work. We are used to industrial life and we like it and we like driving around and we like living in a relatively luxurious manner, which even the most modest person in Santa Fe does with flush toilets and showers and all those kinds of things. But there is probably going to have to be either a major crisis in which everybody suffers or some kind of middle path.
You know, I agree, and I think it's fascinating because I was sitting here thinking about genetically engineered crops, and I carried a bill in the legislature that was hugely controversial, made it through a committee before it was kind of squished to its death in a very unceremonious way on the Senate floor.
But with no doubt lots of lobbying by industry.
Big ag. And so the fascinating thing is that I've seen one of the responses to the drought is to go into the laboratory and come up with some new genetically engineered crop that can function better in a drought environment with less water. And I think you're absolutely right, though, that this is going to force us as a society to have these types of discussions and what direction we want to go and what directions are really options for us to go. And again, it's kind of, I keep using the analogy of the perfect storm, but it's everything is hit at once. And I don't think the idea that this is a drought that's going to just end and everything's going to be back to normal is a reality. The climate is changing, and I think this is all kind of interconnected, and we need, it's a new world moving forward.
Now, one of the things that I think is important to talk about as we wrap up is the question of democracy. I mean, you said we really need to get all water users around a table with presumably a lot of good coffee and food on that table for days, if not weeks, if not months, years, and hash this out. This is a question of democracy in action. And in our system today, we are always in that tension between, on the one hand, the people who are using water and living their lives, and on the other hand, this gigantic phenomenon of big business, whether it be big agriculture or oil and gas or whatever, who are doing things kind of behind the scenes that actually direct what laws are passed and how we live.
I think that's true, and again, I think their ability to continue with the status quo is, I think, the message that comes through. It's just not an option anymore. So all of a sudden, we've managed to work our way along without putting the money into the courts to adjudicate. We've managed to kind of work our way along without dealing with priority administration. We bought our way out of the last lawsuit, and I just don't think those are options anymore. And so the question becomes, and one of the big discussions that we had this session is, there is a process, active water resource management, very controversial, that the state engineer has put in place, which has some mechanisms to encourage this type of cooperation. But it's also coming under the auspices of the state engineer, who happens to be the party against whom all the water right holders litigate. So I just think that the cooperation component is the critical piece, and somehow we've got to create the forum for these big users, small users, because the small users may well have priority over some of the big users. They've got to be in a position where they're coming up with their own solution. And
do you have any vision of, I mean, even piecemeal vision of how you think things could be made better in the short to medium run?
Well, I think the first thing that has to happen is we've got to allow for water users to be able to share. And so one of the things that can't happen is someone's farm is fallowed because there's not enough water and somehow they're losing their rights. So I think that needs to be in place. And then, quite frankly, we have got to get the adjudication process done so that we know who has what.
Yeah.
And I just think that necessarily, there are many families in agriculture where the next generations don't want to do it. And so if water's going to move between rural and urban, again, it should be done in a way that's beneficial to everyone.
Peter Wirth is state senator from New Mexico, District 25, here in Santa Fe. And tonight he will be speaking as part of the Amigos Bravos Water Matters Lecture Series. It's at 5:30 at the Santa Fe Community Foundation, which is on Helena Street here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
I'm delighted to welcome back to the Radio Cafe David Geist. He's a pianist, he's host of Geist Cabaret at Pronzo, and Robert Sinn, vocalist, man about town, hard to pin down. And they are going to be performing a concert of Kurt Vile songs called From Darkness to Light. It's this coming Sunday, the 23rd of June at 7:30 at the Santa Fe Playhouse. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's
so
good to be here.
So tell us about Kurt Vile. Probably a lot of people don't know his name, but they've heard a lot of his music.
Kurt Vile was originally from Germany. He started out, came from a family of cantors. He thought he was going to be a classical musician in the German tradition at the time. He studied with Busoni and Engelbert Humperdinck, the original Engelbert Humperdinck.
Right.
And
not the composer of Fly Away Lesbian Seagull.
No. And he found himself drifting into a different style of music, a cabaret form, a musical form. He collaborated with Bertolt Brecht and had a very successful career in Germany in the 1920s, early 30s. But then his whole life or existence started to fall apart. He was subject to persecution under the Nazis. He and his wife learned that their names were on a list of people who were likely to be picked up, and so he began to look for work outside of Germany and very wisely left, and eventually came to New York and had a very successful career writing Broadway musicals.
Very wise indeed.
Yes.
What a scary moment in history. Now, what were some of the musicals for which he's most famous?
Well, Lady in the Dark, One Touch of Venus, Lost in the Stars, and then there's one that he isn't famous for, which I'm very impressed with and will be dealing with in the show. It was an anti-war musical in 1938 called Johnny Johnson.
Really?
Yes, right.
Don't know that one.
Well,
are you featuring music from it?
Yes. The final song in the show is called Johnny's Song, or Listen to My Song, from Johnny Johnson, and it's a plea for world peace.
Very interesting. Now, don't forget the Three Penny Opera.
Three Penny Opera, right. I was naming Broadway shows. He was most famous for the Three Penny Opera in Europe. Yeah, there were productions of it all over Europe, and he also did Mahogany and Happy End, all in Germany.
And he featured the not necessarily most beautiful voice of all time, but very expressive voice of Lotilenia.
That's right. She started out in his production. She was a very pure soprano at the time, always a good interpreter of his work. And then by the time we got to know her in this country, she had a very, what you could call a devastated voice, still a very effective voice, but I always said it sounded like she had Drano on her cornflakes in the morning. But there was nothing she couldn't sing. It was very impressive.
And so you are singing, and David is playing the
That's
piano,
right.
And you've been doing this for some years.
Well, Bob and I have known each other almost since I first got to town, believe it or not, almost 8 years ago. And Bob has really educated me as far as Kurt Weill's music goes. I had exposure to Kurt Weill when I was in New York as an audition pianist, and a lot of his music would come through the standards like September Song and Mack the Knife and such. And of course the music of Cabaret, John Kander's music, obviously is highly influenced by Kurt Weill. But my association with Bob and this particular concert, Bob really gave me a historical aspect that I really felt like I really got the tradition of what Kurt Weill's music is about. He really is a protest composer. I mean, he was really embodying a period. It wasn't a pretty sound. It wasn't a pretty time, and the music really reflects that. So my first experiences of him were through the musical Cabaret, but Kurt Weill's music really on its own, it's pretty dark stuff. It really is. The harmonies are very dissonant, and it really hits a certain deep part of the soul.
And it's interesting, some composers and artists and filmmakers respond to dark times with dark art. Some respond with escapist art.
Right.
Which is just so beautiful and magical and lifts you out of that so that people can at least forget for 15 minutes.
Right. Exactly.
And some of the American musical songs that he wrote are more escapist than certainly the German material.
Interesting. So you are playing, Bob is singing. Have you been in a long rehearsal process? I mean, it must be fun to work with one another.
Well, we've worked for about 6 years on other material, and then the last year we've worked almost exclusively on the Kurt Weill material. And I would like to say that as a young person, I was very much interested in the music of the American musical stage. The music of Kurt Weill was the last thing that I got to, and I was in awe of it, and as a young person, I sort of shied away from it, and I sort of joke at this point. At this point in my life, I feel that I have suffered enough through certain things that I have something to bring to the songs at this point.
Yeah.
And remains to be seen, but that's what I'm aiming at.
Bob and I sort of have an agreement. We're calling him Kurt Weill. That's the American pronunciation, and then the European pronunciation is Kurt Weill. So we've sort of
interchange it.
Well, we interchange it when we talk about him. But just for the sake of consistency, we've been calling him Kurt Weill. But we've been working on this for the last year, and it's been a great collaboration. And Bob and I have a history of working in my cabaret room together, and also at other clubs around town. So this piece, I do think, is the most thoroughly rehearsed, well-conceived piece we've ever done. And I've even created keyboard sounds that I will be using when we do the production at the Santa Fe Playhouse that reflect also the era and the time.
Kurt Weill was very much influenced by American jazz and the orchestrations of the 1920s in America, and he used unusual instruments like harmoniums and accordions and barrel organs and banjos, and it brings a wonderful effect to the music.
So. We're using all those in this keyboard that I've got.
We're not talking about a piano.
I'm going to play it on synthesizer, and I'm going to use these particular sounds, accordion sounds and banjo sounds and almost circus-like sounds to create that atmosphere. So I've actually orchestrated it to really enhance the atmosphere.
Kurt Weill also worked with the German playwright Bertolt Brecht.
That's right. They collaborated on three major works, and then that ended with Kurt Weill coming to the United States.
Right. Shall we play a song?
Yeah, let's play a song. Which one do you think would be good, Bob? I mean, we could...
I think the Mac the Knife is good and very familiar to people.
Okay, well, let's hear that.
Yeah.
Oh, the shark has pretty teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has McKeith, dear, and he keeps it out of sight. From a tugboat in the harbor, a cement bag's dropping down. The cement's just for the weight, dear. If first you don't succeed, then try and try again. And if again you don't succeed, try and try and try. Useless, it's useless, our kind of life's too rough. Take it from me, it's useless, trying ain't enough. Louis will disappear, dear, after drawing out his cash. And McKeith spent like a sailor. Did our boy do something rash? Jenny Diver, Suki Tawdry, Holly Peachum, Lucy Brown. Oh, the line falls on the right, dear. Now that Maggie's back in town. Yes, the line falls on the right, girl.
Robert Sinn and David Geist in the performance of Mac the Knife. Now, we know this song both from Bobby Darin singing it in English in this really swinging version, but also La Delenia doing a very, very different style.
Absolutely. La Delenia, just to give a little bit of back history, I mean, she was obviously married to Kurt Weill. But
yeah, she was married. I mean, we didn't mention that before. Yeah. They were husband and wife.
And in fact, Bob even knows more about the history. I think they were remarried more than once.
Yeah, she divorced him and then decided it was wise to remarry him, and so she did. She was very unfaithful to him, and that's a long story. But she dedicated, in spite of that, after he died, she dedicated her life to bringing his music forward and making it better known, and set up a foundation which still exists in New York to do that.
you know, getting back to the musical Cabaret, as I mentioned earlier, I think that was one of the most brilliant casting choices in the history of Broadway when Harold Prince put Lottie Lane in the musical Cabaret, because he tied in that world, he tied in that era just so unbelievably well. Lottie Lane, she was known for this particular style of singing called Sprechenspiel, which is sort of the turn of the century, turn of the 20th century German singing, where it was partially sung, partially spoken, and it was sort of a growl, and it was not meant to be a pretty sound. It was meant to be something sort of harsh, almost an effect, very intentionally, because of the expressionistic
but
era.
Full of emotion.
Yeah, absolutely. So sort of this speak-singing kind of tradition that I think does sort of permeates through the world of Cabaret, not so much the musical Cabaret, but the whole style of people singing intimately. She was really, I think, the pioneer of that. And so I think it's interesting that this music that we're so drawn to is very much, it's a tradition that's carried into, you know, American art form, that speak singing, even Broadway, musical theater. I mean, the real great Broadway people, it's really about the story first. And so even Sondheim will say he'd rather hear somebody speak the song than sing it beautifully. You know, to sing it, just, you know, sing it correctly, you know, in that sense. You know, there's
just because there's so much room for a certain kind of emotional
exactly.
expression.
Exactly. It's more real. Exactly.
But then again, as you were saying, Robert, before, when you've lived a life and you've suffered and you come to a song about suffering, you can bring something to
right.
that
you know
in
to
your
bring
singing.
To it.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the event is From Darkness to Light, a tribute to the composer Kurt Weill. It's this coming Sunday, the 23rd of June at 7:30 at the Santa Fe Playhouse. And you can buy tickets at the door, or you can go to the website santafehadassah.org. You can also call area code 817-422-1250. Now, this is a benefit for Hadassah?
It's a benefit for Hadassah. They provide... hospitals, trained nurses, provide general medical care in Israel.
And so your money will be going toward that.
That's
and
right.
A lovely evening with David Geist, pianist, and once again host of Geist Cabaret at
Thank
Pranzo,
you, Mary Charlotte.
Which is a wonderful thing. There's this upstairs room in Pranzo that has its own separate and slightly different menu, which is fabulous. And you play piano and sometimes sing and sometimes have guest artists there.
Absolutely. Just to correct the menu aspect, we've gone back to now the original Pranzo menu for both upstairs and downstairs. That was just a recent change. But yeah, it's a space that I'm incredibly proud of. And I know you've been so helpful and supportive of what I've been working on bringing to Santa Fe. And
it's good. It's fun.
We have a great time up there. And it's always full of surprises. And we have wonderful guest artists that do come by. Kay Ballard, Sally Kellerman, just to name a few. I mean, we've had Robert Sinn. I mean, we've had some really great names over the years, and it's a lot of fun, and we're getting a nice little, mighty little reputation. I'm very, very proud of it.
Yes,
thank
indeed,
you.
And people who come to Santa Fe from outside of town, just visiting, they know to go up there, too.
There's been a yearly continuity. I can see guests that come by year after year, so it's been wonderful. Yeah, absolutely.
And Robert Sinn, vocalist and man about town.
Bon vivant.
Bon vivant.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we look forward to seeing you on Sunday.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.